Nancy Perozzo on June 21st, 2013. And this interview is taking place in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And I will have our narrator introduce himself and a little bit about the kind of work that he does.
Thanks, Nancy. My name is Murray Fulton. My name is Murray Fulton. I am a professor at the University of Saskatchewan. I'm an agricultural economist by training, and for many years was a member of the agricultural economics department at the university. More recently, I've moved over to the Johnson Shoyama Graduate School of Public Policy.
And what is that?
Is
it associated with the university?
Oh yes, it's a graduate school. We train master's and PhD students in the area of public policy. Our big sort of flagship program is a professional program that trains people for the public service, nonprofit sector, that sort of thing. Plus we also have research degrees at both the master's and the PhD level.
Great. Now, we usually start these interviews with talking to people about how they became involved or interested in the grain industry aspect.
Right.
So can you tell us a bit about your history and
how
it unfolded?
I guess probably the place to start. I grew up on a farm in southern Saskatchewan, a small town called Kincaid, Saskatchewan. Spent my summers there, and so got introduced to the grain industry sort of firsthand. I then came to, eventually ended up in university, migrated to agricultural economics, because I was the ag industry interested me. It was something I knew something about, or I thought I did. And what really intrigued me was the way people organized their activities. What I now know is the organizations and the institutions that sort of govern the way that we work and interact on a daily basis. It was that interested me. I actually didn't have much interest in how plants grew or how animals digested their material. Not that that's not important, it's just that isn't what made my brain sort of tick. So I ended up going into agricultural economics because that was the place that was looking at these questions of human interaction, human decision making. And as you move into the academic world, you look for interesting areas where there's things happening that need to be explained, that are unique, that are academics don't go looking at the stuff where it's just the same old, same old. You look for things where there's something interesting going on. And the grain trade over the years has provided, if you like, ample fodder for that kind of investigation. So I think in a nutshell, that's where I came. It's just a fascinating area. I must admit I was drawn initially to debates like, because these were very, very much part of what the discourse, the discussion when I was going to university, questions about the wheat board, the role of the wheat board, questions about the role of multinational corporations, all these issues that have sort of dominated the grain trade, in fact, since its inception here in its introduction to Western Canada back at the turn of the 20th century. Those issues kept coming back again and again in different guises. And so in a way, wasn't just looking at the grain trade per se, but in fact, these are the questions that were being played out in the grain trade were ones that are in some ways really fundamental to these are key questions that society keeps asking themselves about where's that balance between individual action, individual freedom, collective action, collective goods. What's that balance between the group and the individual? How much involvement should the state have? How much involvement should the market have? These are age-old questions that keep coming back in different guises. And the grain trade has been a great place to explore some of those and see how people deal with them and react to them.
Oh, geez, we're going to have to speak at double time. Because as you said, all of those issues are, if you've read anything on the history, they do recur, but they have been just a flurry of activity over the last 20 years.
That's right.
Now, I want to ask a question related to my part of the country. I'm not even certain if you have a comment on it, but I thought I'd get it out of the way first, and then we'll go to more recent history, if that's okay with you. The focus of our project is on developing what a fellow at Lakage University, Livio Di Matteo, calls the grain industry nexus, which is where the rail, the ships, and the handling facilities were developed. So if you think back on what you just said about what your area of study is, do you have any comments to make on how that developed and how that fit into those decisions about private versus public and individual?
Yes, so there's other dimensions to the grain trade, and the one that you've just highlighted is one of these other dimensions. In some ways, it touches upon some of these other debates that I was just mentioning, but in some ways it's a separate one. But here, it's a debate that's gone on again over the centuries about how does a particular industry develop industrially? What are the components? Who are where geographically are some of these hubs located? And very, you know, we see this in the other key sectors where then there is there's a change over time in terms of where that hub is located. And I think that, you know, what you've seen in the case of the Lakehead Thunder Bay is that was the key at the beginning of the 20th century. That was the key conduit for grain coming from Western Canada. It is no longer that. It's all shifted to the West Coast. And so this now has issues of industrial development, rise and fall of regions, ebb and flow of both political and this particular issue. And so there is a connection, but in some ways they're very much their own sort of area of study or area of interest.
One of the conclusions that I've gradually come to, which I'd like to sort of check out with you in speaking to different people, is some of those changes, the actual local community has little control over.
Right, that is right.
And would you say that's the...
Yeah, because when you start thinking about these... So we were doing... we were just talking about these industrial changes that are occurring sort of on a more macro scale within Canada. So this move from the Lakehead to the West Coast. But of course, what was also happening at that same time is dramatic changes. In fact, much more dramatic even than what went on at the macro level, at sort of the micro level, these tremendous changes going on within those communities at the same time that those communities were undergoing other changes. They were losing population, they were losing services, schools, hospitals, grocery stores, etc. And so there was something going on. The developments in the grain trade, of course, although the grain trade would look at them sort of independently, they weren't independent. They were part of a much larger industrialization of the grain industry in Western Canada and all the things that went with that.
So when you think, when you look at it historically, and we certainly see the developments, both recent and past, and although Western Canada may not have been aware of it, interested in an earlier comment that you made saying that it's been a sort of a maybe since forever situation where humans have tried to decide how much public, how much private, mm-hmm. how much individual.
Yes.
So if you think back to the early development of the early grain trade,
yes.
and the rail ships, the companies.
Yes.
What kind of balance do you think was achieved there? Or was even in the early days there a shift in Canadian acceptance of involvement from, like, maybe I'm not being too clear, but what I'm thinking of, for example, is the railways.
Right.
That individuals would not have been able to build the railways.
Right.
But was there a time, you know, was there a shift in when government was actively involved? What changed? Is that making any sense?
Oak, the economic historian who was here at the University of Saskatchewan, he links the development of the grain trade to, in fact, the development of Canada. This was part of nation building. The pushing of the railway across Canada was in part to secure for Canada the West, so that the West didn't migrate to the United States and become part of the United States. That was that was obvious that was a key aspect of pushing the railway across. And then but as you push that railway across, it isn't just enough to have the railway there. You need people to be able to populate it and to be connected in some way then to what's going on in other parts of, particularly central Canada. And so that there was this, and he was writing with other people that were writing at the time. Innes, for instance, looking at putting forward this idea that there was a periphery that was supplying the central core. And the periphery was in essence, was the prairies. When on the other side of central Canada, it was the East Coast. That was being, the institutions were being set up in some ways to funnel the demand for goods and services into the central part of Canada where the manufacturing base was, and so they would produce the farm machinery, the supplies that farmers needed. They would be shipped out on the rail, and come back would be the grain. And this, I mean, the fascinating thing looking back on this is that I think going on, in some ways, he probably overstated it, but it didn't matter because what he did get right was that was the myth. That was the way that the West did perceive themselves and their role within Canada. That, in turn, drove many of the decisions. Let me just connect this back up. So part of this nation building is the state saying we need to be involved in creating a railway. That's a critical element. they do that in a couple of ways. The state itself, in some cases, builds the railway. In other cases, they give very strong property rights to a private company in order to be able to build it. And this becomes sort of a hallmark of Canada, is some involvement by the public sector, and then some involvement by the private sector, which we have seen played out in some ways. I think the end of the Canadian Wheat Board marked the end of an era where that balance seems to be now shifted much, much more to, it's the private sector that's involved. But, if in 100 years there's somebody else doing these kind of interviews, we may well have seen the pendulum shift back by that time, but because we are talking about that kind of time scale that these things occur over.
Now, you talked about the myth, and I wondered that myself. How much of seeing today how things just happen or seem to just happen, how much of the development of the grain industry was actually planned, successful as it turned out to be? The members of the government actually planning to have companies, or to see companies set up in the West, or did it just happen?
No, I think that there was more than just it was more than it just happened. It's very clear. The government sent out the Palliser expedition on a couple of occasions. Now here's where I have to go back, and I can't remember all my history, but you have at least two or three surveys of the West as to its suitability for growing crops. And on the basis of that, could be undertaken. So there is, I think, a deliberateness that is at play here, where people are looking for they're looking for economic opportunities. And again, you have to think about that particular time, late 1800s. This is the time of exploration, where people are pushing into new frontiers. Europeans and this is really critical. The Europeans are pushing; they're pushing into parts of Africa. They're pushing into northern Canada. They've already pushed across the United States. They're pushing into parts of Central and South America. This is what's going on around the world. The colonial powers are pushing their boundaries out, and this is being driven in part by governments, but also by private business saying, "Can we make money doing this? Are there places where, the geography would work for us to be able to grow?" Grow grain and harvest it and make money, and so they do deliberately take steps to try to put this together. And did they foresee what it has become? No, that would be. That would be stretching things. Nobody can really see very far out into the future. Did they have, in fact, what they were looking at the time? Did they think it was reasonable? Probably not even at that point. I mean, the ads that were placed in European newspapers about the opportunities in Western Canada for advertising, but partly it's, I think, probably this hubris of, if you like, the hubris of that particular era. We're living in a period now, today, 2013, where we've come off this sort of hubris of the early 2000s, which led to the stock market financial crisis in 2008. That's the hubris of today. There is a hubris in the 1880s, the 1890s. It just took a different form. In some ways, I think we need to interpret those ads and so forth as part of that, as a reflection of that hubris. This is what they thought could be created. What was actually created was something very, very different.
Why would you say it's different, or did it just take a whole lot longer to accomplish it?
It's very different because, I mean, to some extent, this was, it turns out that you can grow grains of the different sorts quite well. But I think what we're finding is that in order to be able to do that, we need a technology that is completely outside of any box that people could have imagined back in the 1880s, the 1890s, the 1900s. I was talking to somebody who was just down at the Farm Progress Show in Regina this week, the farm machinery that is on display is, for somebody even from 40 years ago, it would be incomprehensible. GPS systems that can keep track of a cedar that's 90 feet wide and keep track of it to within an inch. This is a far cry from a 6-foot cedar that was being used back in.
I'm going to ask the next question in relation to the railways and then broaden it a bit. You mentioned that the way that the railways were developed in Canada with the private-public partnership,
right,
was our way of operating. So was that not the way in the States? And then secondly, and this moves us into the way that the communities,
right,
progressed, and the difference between the growth of cooperatives in Canada and less so in the States.
Well, actually, maybe not.
Okay.
But yes, there is an interesting, so let's start with the railways.
Okay.
Part of it is that I don't know enough of my railway history in the United States to give you a really complete answer to this. What I can say is the U.S. relied much more, the U.S. relied much more on the private sector for their railways than we did. That, I think, is pretty clear. They created at the time, in fact, this was, to be sort of become quite famous, the Grand Railway monopolies, and this was incorporated into monopoly boards, the four railways on the monopoly board, this was the railway and the state using. So let me just try to say this a different way. In the U.S., the state said, we're going to use our power, we're going to make sure that the railways do get built, but we're going to do that by giving them some kind of exclusive ownership of these areas to entice them to be able to build. That's one of the differences where, that's one of the areas where there's a difference between Canada and the U.S. in terms of how we sort of start on our evolutionary path.
Did not Canada do the same thing?
Well, we did both. We had both a private railway and we had a public railway. They come at different times and in some cases piecemeal investments and so forth. But there's a sense of a mix that we don't see in the United States.
How much of that might have been due to the difference in the population size?
I think this is, I was going to actually say this. I think this is I think there's two reasons. There's two, at least two major factors. One would be the one that you've just mentioned, which is population. You have in the American situation much higher population densities with settlers and so forth, and this is because of really a different climatic set of conditions that allows the land to support many more people. And so what we know is, and I'll give you some other examples of this later, this does allow the private sector to move in a way that it can't, say, in Western Canada. But I think that there's also a philosophical difference that's in play. The U.S. Is always much more leery of government involvement and government ownership than Canada has been historically. And this is just one of the sort of tenets of American politics, is that the state doesn't get involved in the same way. And I think you have to make sure that you get that factored in. Now, let me just take this into the co-ops, because this is actually quite interesting. Because this is actually a subtle distinction.
Kent, before you do that, you had said there were two reasons. One was the population size, and the other was the philosophical.
And the other one's the philosophical.
Okay. Sorry?
Yeah. So what's interesting in, again, to think about a comparison between the United States and Canada around the grain trade, is in Canada, by the early 1900s, in fact, late 1890s, we're starting to see some settlers in Western Canada, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and they're starting to produce grain in sufficient volumes to export it, and they start to become concerned about the power that's being exerted by the elevators, and by the railways as well. And two things happen. One is there is, I think this is right. So the first act is the Manitoba Grain Act, and I think it's 1903 or 1904. I should know this. I looked it up a while back, which actually sets out a regulatory framework for both the rail industry and the elevator industry that is picked up and mirrored in many ways in the Canada Grain Act in, I think, 1906, a couple of years later, the piece of national legislation. And there's a willingness of the state, and again, this is partly this difference between Canada and the United States, a willingness of the state to say, we are going to get involved in the regulation of activity. And so producer cars are given legislative authority, so farmers can load their own cars. There's grading rules put in place so that you can cut down on some of the opportunistic behavior that was taking place. These are developments that weren't quite being paralleled in the United States, where they were relying more on creating competition rather than some of the regulation.
Now, that leads me to ask the question, what was it about the Canadian politicians that made them make that choice, towards willingness to get in, versus the Americans that said, took a more hands-off approach?
It's a very good question, and perhaps someone has done the economic history around that, and I don't know.
Personalities. Experiences.
Again, I think probably a bit of philosophy, and it would certainly be, I mean, if I was looking to try to explain it, I would take a look at who were those groups that had influence over the government at the time.
And again, I know that I'm sort of pushing you outside of your the area that you've spent more time in, but would Britain be more similar to Canada in that way?
I don't know enough about Britain to be able to comment. But it's clear that we were borrowing. But having said that, it is clear that we were borrowing ideas from Britain, because many of the legislators were British, and they were bringing concepts from there. This you know, willingness of Canada to have government involvement, though, only goes so far, because as farmers started to complain about the competitive nature of the local elevators, there were many cries, if you like, for people to, by the people involved, for the government to get involved and actually own the elevator companies. And in all instances, well, no, that's not true. Manitoba, there was actually a bit of an experiment with government involvement. In Saskatchewan and Alberta, though at that point they weren't in, well, in 1905 they were, so we're straddling that period when they become provinces, that impulse is resisted quite firmly. And they say, no, we're not going to get involved. Instead, what the state did, this is the provincial governments, they said, we would actually encourage farmers to own the elevator companies. And this is really in the grain trade, the beginning of the cooperative movement.
Now you started to, and I took you off track, you started to say it was quite interesting about the co-op movement in Canada versus the US.
Yeah, so interestingly, there is at the same time, 15 years earlier, perhaps, in the United States, a very similar movement going on in the grain, in a whole variety of agricultural commodities. Grain in California, its fruits and vegetables, and on the Great Plains, its grain, and so you're seeing the development of agricultural cooperatives there. Roughly the same time, again, about maybe 10, 15 years earlier, and that's simply because this is the time gap between the settlement period in these two regions. So in some ways, these are actually quite similar, and in some ways, you're seeing in this respect, you're seeing a set of institutional developments occurring in the same geographical region, I'm thinking of the Great Plains, that is quite similar all the way through the Great Plains, regardless. So in some sense, the border doesn't matter in terms of how people are responding to these. Now, even this, though, goes only so far, because it turns out that there actually is a difference at the border. But we actually have to kind of wait until the 1930s to see this. And what we see in the 30s is this is taking us away from the grain trade a little bit, but this is important. What we see in the 30s is the rise of, this is the period of rural electrification, or this is the beginning of rural electrification. Electricity is now coming to farms. You need to find some way of providing the service to these, in some cases, quite remote rural areas. This takes us back to our population question. In both Canada and the United States, the private companies are unwilling to move out into the rural areas. They can supply electricity to the urban areas quite nicely. A little bit later, they can supply telephone services to the urban areas quite nicely. They can make a nice profit. To step out and try to supply this to rural areas is much more problematic. And yet, there's this demand. There's still a significant enough population in the rural areas that they have political influence. And so the government feels compelled to try to do something. What's interesting by the 30s is that the response in Canada and the U.S. are different. And in the U.S., it's government saying we are going to encourage the formation of cooperatives. And this is the formation of the rural electric co-ops and the rural power utilities. Almost all at the time were organized on a cooperative basis. In Canada, at least in Saskatchewan and Manitoba, to a lesser degree in Alberta, but even there, the response was for the state. Initially for municipalities to become involved, for instance, in telephone provision. This is local government. Eventually, as the need for consolidation occurred, the state then took over those municipal systems. This is a different response. It partly reflects this greater willingness of Canada to look at public sector solutions, whereas the U.S. Would always shy away from that as the option. What they went to was the encouragement of individuals to form co-ops to do this.
If we look at the grain industry, though, is it the opposite, or were there because it would be, and I may be completely off base here, companies such as the Saskatchewan Cooperative Elevator Company, the Saskatchewan Wheat Pool, the
right.
Alberta and Manitoba Wheat Pools were growing.
Yes.
Was that happening in the States?
Yeah, or? Yeah. So at that time, starting in, so you're right, you've got the Saskatchewan Elevator Company starting in, the initial elevators that were to become that system starting in, 1908, that period. That same period in the United States, there is something very similar going on. Aaron Shapiro, the California lawyer who was helped set up some of the marketing co-ops for fruits and vegetables in California. Of course, he comes to Western Canada to talk about pooling play some role in the formation of the pools here. So there is this similarity during this period, and this actually links up with something else that my economic historian colleagues keep reminding me of, and that is that there was this, during that early part of the 20th century, the one that we always focus on is this inflow of settlers from Europe, and we pay a lot of attention to the Ukrainians coming and the Finns and the Swedes and these different ethnic groups coming, in part being driven out of their areas because of the political and economic upheavals that are occurring back home. What people don't talk about, but which is actually very important, was the settlement of people who had settled in America or who had been in America even for a generation, coming up to Canada. My wife's family, that's their way into Western Canada, was through the United States. This is one of the ways that these ideas of how to organize get transferred. These things don't just happen through the wind. They get transferred by people who arrive where they came from, because they need a model to select from.
What brought them? Do you know what was going on that Pushed or pulled?
Both. And I think you'd have to go into, you know, the individual stories of different families and so forth. In some cases, it was being pulled by...
free land still available?
Free land still available in Western Canada. This was very attractive to, or almost free land still available, whereas land was starting to become more expensive in the United States. I suspect that some of the people ended up here because they couldn't make a go of it down there. And so then they move. They probably didn't make a go of it here either, but, you know, they kept moving. Some people I suspect that there would be instances where people were sort of more driven from their locale, and I'm thinking about sort of, I suspect that this is true. I'd have to go back and check that there would be ethnic groups that weren't finding it hospitable in whatever area they had settled in the United States, and so they were moving to a place where they could form something that was a bit more to their liking.
Because of the relatively short time we have today, I'm going to fast forward.
Yes.
Talk about, because it has an impact on Thunder Bay every time there was a major amalgamation, put it that way, in the grain industry, it impacted Thunder Bay in that at least one terminal elevator would be
yes.
decommissioned. What happened? What were the winds of change blowing?
Yes.
To create the, I think we have a pretty good understanding of what created the wheat board initially, what created the co-ops initially.
Right.
And then when did the change start to occur that those institutions were on the chopping block?
Right.
And why the acceleration of it?
So let me, there's a whole bunch of things here to talk about. So let's talk about the consolidation first. I talked earlier about the tremendous difference in the scale of farm machinery. But in fact, we have to actually think beyond just what was happening on the farm, though in many ways, by far and away the largest. But in fact, all the way through all aspects of the grain trade, we see this, I used the term earlier, this industrialization going on. This increasingly, you know, the history of agriculture really is making, trying to take this biologically based enterprise that is subject to, in its sort of initial form, subject to a tremendous amount of variation. So the obvious one that comes to mind is the weather, you know, droughts, floods, etc. But in fact, the variation is much bigger than that. You can think of the variation in even within a particular variety of the qualities of wheat and the very different properties they have in terms of bread making or what have you. And if you think about this world as one where we start with this huge variety in all dimensions, this huge variation on all dimensions, in many ways, the history of agriculture has been to try to reduce that variability as much as possible. Now, there's only so much you can do on the weather side, but the agricultural scientists have made huge advances in terms of reducing the variability on other dimensions. And it isn't just the technology, it's the technology alongside the way that we've organized the system to segregate grades into increasingly narrow categories that are really very, very homogeneous. Variety of this particular grade, this particular protein will behave in a mix. And then you change the formula just a little bit and it behaves in a very, very different way. And this has been going on in the grain sector. If you go to the livestock sector, particularly chickens and hogs, going on to even a greater degree there, where this is really what the industry has been about. The other thing, of course, so that's one aspect of this technological development. And the other aspect of the technological development is growing more from less, using fewer inputs to get more output. And that involved switching, as the ag scientist went to work on those problems, what they ended up doing was finding that they had to switch inputs, more of other things to get more output. And so this is partly why you see this is the reason why you see this tremendous exodus of people from agriculture, is because labor is being substituted for other inputs, and the other inputs are increasingly based upon what's cheap in the economy, which is oil, petroleum products. So you're seeing the rise of fertilizers and chemicals and so forth, as these become the cheaper way to produce output in a much more. And of course, they also provide, not only are they cheaper, but they're also providing this reduction in variability. So the introduction of fertilizer means that yields become more homogeneous over fields, which is farmers find advantageous. The use of chemicals allows farmers and the whole industry to remove foreign matter and weed seeds and so forth. All of this, of both of these, is this greater, you could call it mechanization, but I'm going to call it industrialization, because the industrial sector, if you think about sort of the manufacturing, is all about being able to really accurately predict. If I, have this much steel, I'm going to get this much of a particular part. And what we've seen in agriculture moving is more and more to that kind of industrial model. And as you do that, you can then import all of the techniques from the industrial sector. And so with that comes scale. And scale at the farm level, and its scale at the local elevator level, and its scale at the terminal level. And so what you saw both on the West Coast, but in the case of Thunder Bay, it's being influenced by these larger technological changes. The organizational structure of the industry has to change. What we know from sort of basic industrial economics is that if you have this technology that is highly industrialized, the corresponding industrial structure is one that's highly concentrated. These two things go together. And the reason is quite simple. You've got the industrialization allows you to operate on a very, very large scale. New management systems, new information technology systems that we start to see being developed, that allows individual managers to govern and manage increasingly large organizations, so they can actually manage this larger industrial scale, and so all this just feeds into ever larger organizations, and in a way, this is the technological argument as to what was happening at the lake.
So regardless of the fate of the wheat pools, the consolidation was going to occur in any case.
Exactly. Yes, absolutely. You know, this is actually a good way to get into what happened to the pools. I've written quite a bit about what happened to the Saskatchewan wheat pool, and it's clear that by the late 1980s, early 1990s, the people in charge of the pool knew this. They knew that they were going to have to change their industrial structure quite significantly, and the activities that they undertook in the mid-1990s to build large concrete elevators and so forth was a reflection that they knew that they needed recognition, that they needed to probably consolidate them. There were discussions as early as the late 80s of the three pools actually merging, and what stopped that from happening were the personalities involved. You had at least two individuals that were running these respective organizations that each thought that they were king of the hill, and there was no way that they were going to give up that spot. And so there were other issues as well, but that was certainly part of it. So they set out trying to find a way of making this transformation in their technological structure, and playing with what they needed to do, starting to think about what had to happen organizationally to try to bring this into a larger scale that would correspond to their technology. And they failed. They didn't get it right. And what they didn't get right was they moved. They needed to move, but they moved too fast. They took on too many things. They were trying to restructure in too many different parts of the system at the same time. And they couldn't handle all the stuff that was going on. And two or three of these things all moved together at the same time. They all moved down, and they had too much debt, and they couldn't take it on. But they understood that they needed to do that, to make that switch, because there was this, I mean, to call it an imperative is a bit too strong, but that industrial structure is such an important driver of costs and so forth, that if they were going to actually survive as an organization, they knew that they needed to be able to change that structure.
Was there, when you think of, so many questions arise. One, the result, because of mistakes and personalities, was a disappearance of the co-ops, at least as any major player.
Yes.
What impact have you seen to date of that change of ownership? And what would you predict, if any, changes from private ownership versus cooperative ownership?
Excellent question. Really, and it's a really hard one to answer. And I, let me just say something about why it's a hard one to answer, because this is really an important sort of concept to get across of why these things are so difficult to say. Well, you know, this is what it would, you know, this is what the impact of these developments might be. The reason it's such a hard question to answer is that one could say it's impossible to know what the counterfactual is, what would have happened had this not occurred, okay? And one of the things I tell my students is you have to think about two parallel universes where everything's bumping along in these two universes exactly the same, and then at one point in time, something changes in one of them, and it doesn't happen in the other one, but everything else continues the same, the same drivers of technology, the same changes in the economic environment, et cetera, occur in both environments, and then you keep running your movie, if you like, and you try to see then what happens over the next number of years, right? And then what you really want to compare is what's happening in these two parallel universes. And we know what happened in the one that we're in. We don't know what happened in the one that we're not in. And when I say it's impossible, it is literally impossible to know what that would have been.
Have other jurisdictions, you know, you mentioned that the yes. U.S. was operating 15 years in advance of Canada on the
right.
development of the cooperative. So,
right. I think that this is a very good point. So while it's technically impossible because Canada is Canada and you can only have Canada, one can sort of get a peek at what this parallel universe might be by looking at some other jurisdictions. And the U.S. is a good example. There, on the grain side, what we saw was a failure of a couple of their large ag co-ops, Farmland Industries, under very similar circumstances to the pool, failed for very similar reasons, taking on, making too many gambles at the same time and having them all, as the saying goes, go south at the same time. But they've held on to some of their co-ops. And what we know about what's happened to those co-ops is that they are now very, very large. They have diversified in the way that the other multinationals have done. The large co-ops that did survive are now looking at becoming international players. They're investing in Europe. They're investing in the former Eastern Bloc. They're investing in lots of places around the globe. So one could say that's probably what would have happened had you seen successful amalgamation of, say, the Three Prairie Pools, had you seen them move a little less aggressively into some of the businesses that they did, so they would have been able to survive. I expect that you would have seen something like that. In terms of the competition at the country level and, you know, what farmers see, I think that there's probably a subtle distinction that happens, though. So while the outward structure of the these large ag co-ops now looks like, in many ways, the outward structure of some of the large multinational grain companies, private companies, I think there actually is something that's different inside their DNA. And there's a little, perhaps, maybe more than perhaps, just a different philosophy about willing to provide just a different level of service than I think some of the private companies might operate. And again, I'll probably go back to that distinction that we were making earlier. When you have areas where there's lots of population, the private companies are going to be quite willing to move into those. They're going to be quite willing to provide a wide range of service. And those are actually the areas you don't have to worry about. The market works very, very well. It's the areas where that isn't the case, where the population is pretty small, relatively speaking, it's a little less attractive for some of the grain companies. And I think there, you may be seeing, that may be one of the places where you see a difference.
We have 20 minutes left. I hope that your 10 o'clock appointment doesn't come early.
No, I have to phone them. So.
Okay. this is a very broad question. What impact does the failure of the co-ops in Canada, let's deal with the failure of the co-ops. What impact does that have on farmer control, if any, and profits, which I think might be more difficult to predict?
I think you're absolutely right. I think the profit side is really difficult to predict. I think that in my mind, I think the bigger loss of these organizations, but in some ways this was the reason for their loss, was that, and so this is all tied up together. It's all, economists like to say, it's all endogenous. There's a feedback effect from one to the other, and it just keeps going around, right? That there was a failure. I mean, if you take a look at the failure of SaaS people, it was a failure of leadership. And it wasn't just the CEOs. It was also the board at the time that didn't keep the CEO and the senior management, getting them to make the sort of proper investments. And so then that actually then makes us, I think, ask, why was there that failure in leadership? What was happening? Why were the right sorts of leaders not coming forward? And I think that ultimately this is the big question I think agriculture is sort of facing. Agriculture, are we going to see which has been the historical norm in both Canada and the United States? Just to take, because again, we've been doing this comparison, where we've had a significant involvement by farmers in the running of the industry in some way, shape, or form. And they do this in myriad ways, but it involves, it actually involves the mundane of, going to board meetings and serving on committees and, working through decisions and just this day-to-day sort of churn of stuff that has to happen and keeping on top of it. And trying to put those individual decisions into some larger context about where the world is going. And I don't have any sort of hard empirical evidence. So this is where I think it's probably more value judgment. But I think that that's actually important for a sector to remain healthy, is when you have... And it doesn't have to be total control, and that's never been the case, but some involvement by a wide range of group of individuals. And I mean, I said just a moment ago that there's no, I don't have any hard evidence. Maybe actually I do. If you take a look again to the economic historians, the people that have been looking at events, for the last, 500 years in various parts of the world. My favorite authors an economist from MIT and a political scientist from Harvard, Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson. And they talk about why nations fail. And they say nations fail when what's created within these nations are a set of institutions that are in essence controlled by a very small group of people. They term this an elite. Countries and regions that have prospered over the last 500 years are ones that have been able to develop institutions that are much more open to a variety of players and a variety of perspectives. And people have been able to effectively challenge existing ways of doing business, existing ways of structuring things. They've been able to be innovative. And in fact, I think that there's a very strong linkage to the work of an important 20th century economist by the name of Joseph Schumpeter, who talked about creative destruction, that the economic systems that, and this is where you can link this up, he talked about creative destruction where an industry would actually, in order to be creative, would actually destroy existing products and existing institutions in order to create new ones. And I think what Acemoglu and Robinson are saying is that the successful countries are those that allow creative destruction to occur, that they allow these areas and activities to fall, as people say, there's an opportunity over here that I could do, but by doing this, it means it's this other area, and it's not good for the area that falls, but it turns out over the centuries that it's actually good for the entire region. And so if I can sort of bring, you need an ability for different people to have a say in the system. And I think this would be what I would worry about is, and it doesn't have to be through the cooperatives, but there does have to be, I think, this openness within our grain system, within our society just generally, because this doesn't apply just to the grain sector. This is about how we organize ourselves as a country, where we're willing to allow all a greater set of people at the table making decisions.
I'm not hopeful for what you've said. And maybe my interpretation is... here's a couple of things that have come up as a result of what you said. First of all, I said I was asking the questions about what farmers stand to gain.
Yes.
Is it accurate to say then that farmers have the work of decision making at the organizational level, which is a cost because there's your time involved, which is what you've said.
Right.
So they've been willing to give that up in return for letting business or the grain companies and et cetera, et cetera, do it?
That's a good question. I actually think that that's one of these sort of really important questions that needs to be better understood. Is this what's actually going on out there? It's a good way of putting it. Have farmers just become tired? Is that cost-benefit analysis that however one sort of thinks that it might be done, whatever goes into that sort of weighing, farmers are saying, I've actually got better things to do.
Yeah.
Now, what the important thing to note here is that, again, there's this endogeneity. Then you will back out, which may actually then further exacerbate the fact that you don't have any involvement, which further makes it costly to get involved. And so these things can feed on each other in some really important ways. Yeah. I think that this is a question that needs to be...
And it's not just in farming. That's happened
just
at
in
the
farming.
Community level.
Absolutely.
That people have just said, no, it's
yep.
I'm not going to do that.
Yep.
And what's the result? Well, the result is, from what you've said, why nations fail. That's why I'm sounding...
yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And you've talked about industrialization and the tendency toward bigness. being inevitable, but where does it stop? So the question that I'd like to ask here then is the result of the failure of the co-ops that has been seen already is private industry and the Canadian piece of that industry is very small relative to, let's say, Cargill and Glencore, which are the, well, and Archer, and Daniels, et cetera, are much bigger. So what's to prevent the Canadian component, which is much smaller, not being able to compete with the large organizations?
I guess I think there's some worries here, but I actually wouldn't be worried about so much about the Canadian component. I think that you know, if there's kind of money to be made in Western Canada, somebody's going to come and eventually sort of play a role. Now, whether we're going to be able to control that or not, that's the question. I'm not sure I'm doing a good job of answering this, Nancy.
That's okay. Can we just leave it at that?
Yeah.
Because I'd like to move on to the wheat board, which was the other other organization that had a substantial amount of farmer input, and that is not the case. Is that fair to say? Any longer?
And potentially, yeah.
Yeah. So what's the impact of that, and how did that happen?
Well, I think that the... I started off at the beginning talking about sort of these big ideas, these big big ideas that philosophers and economists and political scientists and sociologists all have been dealing with, and that is what's the role of the individual versus the role of the this is the way that the wheat board issue was portrayed, and actually because that is the way that it was portrayed, that is why it is an example of that, because that's the way that if you like, the discourse around it took place. Because in the end, I think two things happened. Let me just back up. First of all, what you saw with the removal of the wheat board single desk selling powers a year ago was what political scientists call a punctuated equilibrium. This idea is, it's a long term, but it's a great term. It means that we had an equilibrium for some kind of an equilibrium for actually a very long period of time, about 75-80 years. And then there's a punctuation. New equilibrium will last probably for a fairly long time as well. Economists and political scientists and others are really interested in what causes systems to go from one equilibrium to another equilibrium. And so, first of all, within this equilibrium, it's called an equilibrium, but in fact, even within that equilibrium, things change actually quite a bit. And so if you take a look at the Canadian Wheat Board in the early 1970s, very, very different than the Wheat Board by the mid-2000s. Much more farmer involvement, a Wheat Board that was much more responsive to the demands of farmers. By 2005, they've introduced all kinds of marketing options, et cetera. All of that is changed within this sort of existing structure. But 2012, there's this punctuation, sort of identified two things. One is that you have a discourse that becomes the discourse changes around the wheat board. And the people that were arguing, the argument and the way of looking at the wheat board as the benefit of in terms of the benefits that it would generate to people, the economic benefits. Interestingly, that argument declines in importance, and instead what replaces it is the argument that it's about freedom, it's about individual choice, it's about this quite abstract idea. So this is fascinating to me. You see a examination being replaced with a much more sort of philosophical focus. And the philosophical dimension actually, it's the one that becomes, it has a lot more traction with people than does the economic benefit one. No. Now, you will get people saying, well, in fact, you know, the economic benefit people, you know, the board wasn't able to show that it was there and so forth. And yes, you know, there was that going on at the same time. But I still think that it was, this was an example where this particular idea actually took this idea of freedom. It was the one that really took root and said, nope, this is the idea that we need, and it trumps other dimensions.
Two questions result of those comments. The freedom issue.
Right.
And how much impact did non-farmer messaging,
right,
impact on it?
So
and tied to that was how lazy were the farmers? Maybe I shouldn't use that term, but going back to
right.
How tired were the farmers, I think right. It's a better term.
Yeah. I said there were two factors. One was this rise of this change in the discourse. Mm-hmm. The other one was, of course, a government that came in that was committed to making the change. Now, why was that particular government willing to make the change? Well, this really ties into the question that you were asking, in part because they now knew that they population of farmers. I don't know what that number was, but you don't need 50% to make that switch. My guess is that someplace in the order of about 30 to 35 is enough. In order to keep that original equilibrium, that equilibrium of the wheat board, you probably needed a solid 80% of the farmers behind you. And if you start to get over under 80, it starts to become a bit iffy whether you can keep that system in place. Now, I have no empirical evidence for that. Well, a slight bit from a couple of other jurisdictions, but that's sort of where I think that the magic mark is. That was part of it, but the other part on the political side, and having a government that was willing to do this, is that they were being lobbied in very, very substantial ways by the grain trade. They, from a political perspective, they don't see any downside to making this move, and so they're willing to make that move. And of course, that's what you need. You need a government to actually be able to change the legislation to be able to do it, because ultimately this was a piece of legislation. So those are the two things: a change in discourse, and then a sufficient shift in the political interests that enabled a government that was both sensitive to those as well as sensitive to that economic or that philosophical discourse that was going on.
How much? Just one last question.
Yep.
How much? How much to impact decisions change as a result of those two changes, do you think?
I think it's going to really depend upon what farmers end up doing in other other areas. And it's also going to depend upon what I think the government does in terms of allowing some of that to happen, because I said, as I said earlier, there's feedback connections here. If it's not conducive to having farmer involvement, then farmers don't do it, and then that tends to in turn lead to less control and less influence, which and it just sort of goes on. There's some really important areas so, you know, farmer involvement in the grain trade per se, now fairly small. You still see a little bit in terms of some of the producer-owned facilities around the country and some of the short line railways. But for the, you know, this is relatively small. The big area where there's still room for farmer involvement is in the area of research and development for agricultural products, particularly crops, and one of the big areas that people are now really turning their attention to is what's going to happen to research and development over the next period of time, and can we get sufficient R&D of the right kind to really start to address this issue of food security that people are increasingly raising as a global issue. And so in some ways that's where the real action now lies within the grain industry. And the interesting thing in Canada will be what role will farmers have in that system. And this is where coming back to, you know, the attitude of farmers is going to be critical. Are farmers going to be willing to not just get involved in the decision making, but in order to get involved in the decision making, they actually have to put money into the system to actually help finance the R&D. Now, all the studies indicate that the returns to those investments through checkoff systems and so forth is actually very, very high, higher than any farmer could get in their bank account or on the stock exchange. But they come a long way down the road, they come in sort of intangibles that are hard to measure, because by the time it comes in yields that are, you know, constantly changing, and so you can't. It's hard to do that counterfactual that we were talking about before. Farmers actually could play a really important role if they're willing to put some money on the table to have to then have some dollars to play with, and thereby influence the way the decisions are going.
And will it also impact on what they see as what comes back as an advantage to them, as opposed to as an advantage to private sector?
Yeah, it will. And this is where perceptions are really important, because, you know, our economic analysis indicates that, in fact, even given, you know, the structure of the grain trade, they'll get a fair bit back. There's a perception that, in fact, they won't.
So the discourse. So
we're back to myth and discourse that I started with, right?
I'm sorry, one last question.
Yes.
The North-South are starting to read about development a big elevator or grain handling facility in southeastern Saskatchewan, north of North Dakota. One item in the Western Producer or whatever.
Okay.
Don't know how far along the line is. But we started out the discussion with the East-West.
Yes.
And the development of
yes.
Western Canada. So from the perspective of Thunder Bay, to hear north-south patterns developing 100 years after
yes.
the fact, can you make a brief statement on that?
Yeah. I think that, the big experiment that is Canada is really... In many ways, and I think I think it's been a tremendous success, but it has been to say we are going to politically, we're going to create systems that are going to not give quite as much importance to the north-south connections that are the kind of. I never like to use natural because nothing's ever natural, but the sort of obvious economic linkages are north-south, and the at least
these are
on
probably
the,
geographical.
Well, certainly
shipping.
Certainly geographical, and and certainly on the Great Plains, cultural. I go down to Nebraska once a year to work with a colleague down there, and you can talk to people in Nebraska, and on many levels, on some levels there is a difference between Canada and Nebraska, and other levels you understand them in a way that it's just like that. So there's cultural linkages that are really strong, and what's interesting is 100 years doesn't make much impact on those north-south linkages. Those are going to become increasingly important, that's one of those things that Thunder Bay is going to have to recognize, that East-West that was created by kind of willpower, of this political willpower of the creation of Canada, is going to be slipping, right? Increasingly, and we've seen this over the last 100 years, and we're into a period where that North-South is going to be important. Now, it in part depends upon what happens politically with sort of, if you like, the height of that U.S. border, Canada border, and how many restrictions are put on, I think that those will probably be reasonably low, given other things in the world. But one can never quite tell.
Thank you very much. I could spend much more time, but you don't have that, so.
Well, this has been very good.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.